Now, last night I pointed out that Sidney Sheldon, a very respected novelist, whom I personally respect from personal association because we served together, along with many others, on the Blue Ribbon Committee, the mayor appointed here in Los Angeles to raise the $10 million for the Save the Books campaign after the tragic fire here downtown. I was also chairman of the television telethon committee that Lott Cook and I hosted. And Sidney Sheldon quickly distinguished himself not just as one who gave generously with money, but with his time and energy and talent. So I have a lot of respect for Sidney Sheldon. He has a current bestseller, The Doomsday Conspiracy, his most recent book, and he puts an author's note at the end of it, which lets you know rather clearly that he hasn't come to any final decision about UFOs, though the Doomsday Conspiracy is built around a fictional UFO crash in Switzerland. But it is very clear that he is convinced that there's enough hard evidence regarding UFOs to make intelligent people start taking a look at it. The UFO phenomenon is about where parapsychology was years ago, extrasensory perception. Eventually, some very respected universities began to conduct experimentations in parapsychology or extrasensory perception, and now to the intelligent people who paid attention to the data, it is no longer a questionable fact. Extrasensory perception, or the evidence thereof, exists. The question is how and by what means. But no longer is it poo-pooed as something that doesn't happen. I, as I've said earlier, did my PhD at Stanford University, and I respect as much as anyone who's ever influenced me the professors that counted. But there were some ivory tower nonentities that would poo-poo the power and force of witch doctors in primitive societies. Well, a lot of them are fakers. But when you've traveled the world, as I have and others have, in primitive jungle areas, you also come to grips with a reality of spirit force that's not easily explainable. Now, UFOs, it's pretty clear that Sidney Sheldon is convinced there's enough there to look. And one of the most striking happenings is the Roswell reported UFO crash at Roswell, New Mexico. Now, since we're on Channel 2 in Santa Fe and Albuquerque every night, 7 days a week, and more people are listening, I decided to get on this subject. Well, I got a research team that's right there on the spot. I mean, there's bound to be people in New Mexico that know about this and have some firsthand reports. I want to read something first. There are people that say, well, how could there be a cover-up? I want to read some law to you that I'm going to make a bet most of you do not know exists. Now, we all know that laws and regulations are written and then agencies extrapolate and go beyond. The RICO Act, designed to get conspiracies and corrupt practices and racketeering, allegedly to give prosecutors and the government more weaponry to catch the so-called mafia and drug conspiracies, now is being used against citizens in the corporate world more than it is against the people it was aimed for. And we all know that certain government agencies, the law is passed, and then they write the regulations and go beyond until somebody challenges it. Here is Code of Federal Regulations. Title 14, Section 1211, Extraterrestrial Exposure. Come on over here, Peter. This is straight out of the code book. How many of you knew Title 14, CFR 1211 existed? I'm sure you read the federal code for bedtime entertainment. If we all have to read this before we talk about a possible cover-up. Scope 1211.100. This part establishes a NASA policy, responsibility, and authority to guard the Earth against any harmful contamination or adverse changes in its environment resulting from personnel, spacecraft, and other property returning to the Earth after landing on or coming within the atmospheric envelope of a celestial body. Anybody knows that when that was first written, the intention was to protect against space probes that have left the Earth and then come back. B, security requirements, restrictions, and safeguards that are necessary in the interest of the national security. There's your boilerplate room for interpretation clause. 1211.101. Right here, get in a little closer. Applicability. The provisions of this part apply to all NASA manned and unmanned space missions which land on or come within the atmospheric envelope of a celestial body and return to the Earth. Again, that makes it clear. Its original intent, probably if an overkill of this section were to go to the court and be tested in the court, someone would raise the issue of legislative intent and go back to legislative history. And I think it's pretty clear that the legislative intent was written. You can come to me, I'll tell you when to come back to this. For space probes leaving the Earth and coming back, having been contaminated with atmospheric envelope of some celestial body, and then returning. And body means, I'm sure, in the original legislative intent, planets, moons, other than Earth, celestial bodies. 1211.102, definitions. A, NASA. I don't need that. We know what that is. B, extraterrestrially exposed means the state or condition of any person, property, animal, or other form of life or matter, whatever, who or which has, one, touched directly or come within the atmospheric envelope of any other celestial body, or, two, touched directly or been in close proximity to, or been exposed indirectly to, any person, property, animal, or other form of life or matter, who or which has been extraterrestrially exposed by virtue of paragraph B1 of this section. When the legislators passed this, the majority who voted it as law, I'm sure, did not believe in UFOs. Do not believe that anything would come from outside the earth here. You better believe that this code would be used to apply. As I give an example, if a person or thing A touches the surface of the moon, and on A's return to the earth, B touches A, and subsequently C touches B, all of these, A through C inclusive, would be extraterrestrially exposed. A and B directly, and C indirectly. Now, if there are UFOs, they've probably been here and gone back somewhere and come back, so they qualify. And I can see the in-house attorneys stretching the phraseology to apply the authority. Because here's the authority. I mean, if, and they would get to the heart of the meaning of this law. The idea is if you touch something extraterrestrial, it might carry something that could threaten the security of the earth. It was never conceived that something might come, touch the earth, go back, and come back and touch it again. But here's the power. Quarantine means the detention, examination, and decontamination of any person, property, animal, or other form of life or matter, whatever, that is extraterrestrially exposed. And includes the apprehension, come here, that's where my finger is, and includes the apprehension or seizure of such person, property, animal, or other form of life or matter, whatever. The seizure of what? The apprehension or seizure of what? Such person, property, animal, or other form of life or matter that is extraterrestrially exposed. That means you encounter a UFO, get your tractor and pick up a piece of a crashed spacecraft. If they wanted to, they could probably even apply this to someone who touches a meteorite. They can apprehend and seize such person, property, animal, or other form of life or matter, whatever, that touches. The law has not been, like most laws, they don't apply. I'm a stamp collector. This law really gives the NASA the right to seize those very valuable envelopes that were signed by some of the astronauts that went to the moon and brought back. I mean, some of them sell $20,000-$30,000. There's a whole hobby of collecting these space-related material. But nobody's applying this law because they don't really see that much threat to an envelope signed by Buzz Aldrin or Cooper. Quarantine period means a period of consecutive calendar days as may be established in accordance with 1211-104. We'll get to that. 1211-104, policy. The administrator or his designee of NASA, as authorized by such and such of this chapter, shall in his discretion, it's up to him, determine the beginning and duration of a quarantine period with respect to any space mission. The quarantine period, as it applies to various life forms, will be announced. Designate in writing quarantine officers to exercise quarantine authority. 3, come back here. Determine that a particular person, property, animal, or other form of life or matter, whatever, is extraterrestrially exposed. Determine that a particular person, property, animal, or other form of life or matter, whatever, is extraterrestrially exposed. They make the decision whether you've been extraterrestrially exposed. Come back to me. And quarantine, I'll go back to this, and quarantine such person, property, animal, or other form of life or matter, whatever. The quarantine may be based only on a determination with or without the benefit of a hearing that there is probable cause to believe that such person, property, animal, or other form of life or matter, whatever, is extraterrestrially exposed. Without a hearing. Come to me. You therefore report that a UFO crashed on your farm and you went out and fixed it up. They can quarantine that which you picked up and quarantine you without a hearing. Apprehend, seize, and say, you keep your mouth shut about this, we'll let you go if you say one word. No hearing. It's a federal law. Determined within the United States or within vessels or vehicles of the United States, the place, boundaries, and rules of operation of necessary quarantine stations. Provide for guard service, but contract or otherwise, as may be necessary to maintain security and inviolability of quarantine stations and quarantine persons, property, animals, or other form of life, or matter whatever. Provide for their subsistence. Hold such hearings at such times, in such manner, for such purposes as may be not required, desirable, or necessary unto this part, including hearings for the purpose of creating a record for use and making any determination under this part, or for the purpose of reviewing any such determination. Cooperate with other departments of government. Take such other actions as may be prudent or necessary. That's blank check. Quarantine. During any period of announced quarantine, the property within the posted perimeter of the Lunar Receiving Laboratory at the Manned Spacecraft Center, Houston, Texas, is designated as the NASA Lunar Receiving Laboratory Quarantine Station. Other quarantine stations may be established if determined necessary, as provided in paragraph A4 of this section already read. During any period of announced quarantine, come to me now, no person shall enter or depart from the limits of any quarantine station without permission of the cognizant NASA quarantine officer. That's prison, man. Without a hearing. No bail. No judge. During such period, the posted perimeter of quarantine station shall be secured by armed guards. It means they can shoot you. I can figure that out. Any person who enters the limits of any quarantine station, what if you're married and you're by yourself? Don't you get one phone call to your attorney? No. In this America, it was. Better keep your passport intact. Can I call my wife? If they allow it. If they don't. This is what happens when you write loose canon rules because you don't think there's any such thing as foreign intrusions. Then you turn some bureaucratic power heads loose. Any person who enters the limits of any quarantine station during the quarantine period shall be deemed to have consented to the quarantine of his person if it is determined that he is or has become extraterrestrially exposed. They determine at their own discretion. The administrator, NASA, decides if you've been extraterrestrially exposed and they can grab you, seize you, and put you in quarantine. Then, the next code section here says, anyone who's been quarantined shall have considered to have consented to it. Antichrist ain't far away, friends. At the earliest practicable time, who determines that? Each person who is quarantined by NASA shall be given a reasonable opportunity to communicate by telephone with legal counsel or other persons of his choice. When's the earliest practicable time? They determine it. Other relationships with other agencies. Now here's where it really gets gritty. 1211-106. Actions taken, come down here. Actions taken in accordance with the provisions of this part shall be exercised in cooperation with the applicable authority of any state, territory, possession, or any political subdivision thereof, which means all state and county and city agencies have to cooperate with them. Federal law is supreme. Court. Say your husband or your attorney goes and gets a court order saying, release that man. Because I'm sure there are judges by the quintillion. They don't even know this section exists. NASA officers and employees are prohibited from discharging from the limits of a quarantine station any quarantined person, property, animal, or other form of life or matter whatever during order or other request. Prohibited. Order or demand an announced quarantine period in compliance with a subpoena shall cause of any court or other authority without the prior approval of the general counsel and administrator. Means any order to show cause, any court order, any judge's statement, doesn't matter what it is, they don't have to obey it. Where approval to discharge a quarantined person, property, animal, or other form of life or matter whatever in compliance with such a request, order, or demand of any court or other authority is not given, the person to whom it is directed shall, if possible, appear in court before the other authority and respectfully state his inability to comply, relying for his action upon this 1211-107. In short, judge says, people say federal judges are absolute. Well, not here. The NASA administrator, by his own determination, decides you have had extraterrestrial exposure. He quarantines you. The law deems you to have consented. When it's reasonably practical, you can call your attorney. Your attorney then can go to any court he wants to, and the court judge can issue an order, release you, and the employee under the NASA administrator goes in court, makes an appearance, and says, I respectfully decline to obey your order because of this section 1211-107, which authorizes violation of the order. And including the federal judge who then seeks to impose his order. Whoever willfully violates, attempts to violate, or conspires to violate any provision of this part or any regulation or order issued under this part, or who enters or departs from the limits of any quarantine station in disregard of the quarantine rules or regulations or without permission of the NASA quarantine officer shall be fined not more than $5,000 or imprisoned not more than 1 year or both, 18 U.S.C. 799. So the judge seeking to force compliance with his order to release the quarantined person will be told by the administrator under authority of 1211-107, we respectfully decline to obey your order. And if the judge tries to enforce it, he's in violation 1211-108. And the country thinks a 9-year-old dialogue between Thomas and Hill is important in comparison to this. I get so weary with the juvenile issues that make the news of the media because that's about all their pea brain can comprehend, while issues like this are ignored. I have a very intelligent audience. Doesn't matter what subject I get on, I can count on some of them sending me something additional. And sure enough, I got the latest book on the UFO crash at Roswell by Kevin D. Randall, Captain U.S. Air Force, and Donald R. Smith. A little later than Berlitz. Trying to find the date. Copyright 1991. That's pretty good up. Pretty good up to date. According to meteorological records, on the evening of July 2nd, 1947, a thunderstorm hit the vicinity of Corona, New Mexico. July and August are considered the rainy season because most of the moisture received by the region falls during that time. I don't have to tell you folks listening on Channel 2 that. Thunderstorms are not uncommon, but they're spotty. One field might receive 5 or 6 inches of rain, while another no more than a mile away receives nothing. July 1947 was no different. It was hot and dry, and there were sporadic thunderstorms in the region. During the storm of July 2nd, Mac Brazel heard a crash, one that was louder than thunder and sounded different than the other rumblings. Brazel would later comment on it, but at the time, he wasn't too surprised. The next day, Brazel and Timothy D. Proctor, a young neighbor boy, were on horseback riding the range to determine which fields had received rain. Brazel wanted to move the livestock into those fields because the grass would be softer and greener due to the moisture. During that ride, Brazel came upon a field filled with debris located south of the ranch headquarters. It extended from the top of a small circle of hills, ran down the arroyo, up another hill, and disappeared on the reverse side. There was quite a bit of debris. Some of it was shiny, but most looked like dull metal. There were big chunks and little pieces. The material was packed so densely that the sheep refused to cross it. To Brazel, it looked as if something had exploded while still in the air. Brazel and young Proctor rode down and examined the field. And thus begins the story of the so-called discovery of a crashed UFO with some alien bodies in it. Now, I'll continue if you want me to, but you got to get on the telephone. I'm reading from The UFO Crash at Roswell by Kevin Randall and Donald Smith. It's a 1991 publication. Brazel and young Proctor rode down and examined the field. There was no indication of passengers in whatever had crashed. There was debris, but no sign of a body or bodies. Brazel closely examined. Am I boring you, or you want to hear this? You know, we got a New Mexico audience that can say this is a bunch of baloney, or I'm sure there'll be somebody listening as last night whose grandfather knew this farmer. Brazel closely examined some of the material, surprised by the properties it exhibited. The debris was so thin and so light that it stirred in the wind. It was so strong that most pieces wouldn't flex. Brazel couldn't cut it with his knife, and he couldn't burn it with matches. Brazel picked up some of the smaller fragments. That meant that he came under this extraterrestrial exposure law. And with Proctor, headed off to his nearest neighbors, Floyd and Loretta Proctor, who lived about 10 miles from the ranch headquarters. At the Proctor house, Brazel showed his neighbors a sliver of the material. Well, Loretta Proctor said she didn't know what the stuff was. According to Loretta, her husband tried to whittle on it but couldn't make a mark. Brazel held a match up to it to show that not only wouldn't it burn, it wouldn't even blacken. Brazel suggested they drive down to look at the debris field, but the Proctors declined. Today, Loretta Proctor says we should have gone, but gas and tires were expensive then. We had our own chores, and it would have been 20 miles round trip. Brazel didn't know what to do about the material in his field. Tommy Tyree, who began working for Brazel a month or so after the event, said that Brazel was irritated about the situation. Because the sheep would not cross the field, Brazel had to drive them the long way around to get them to water. He wanted to know who was going to clean up the mess because he was too busy to take the time to do it. During the 4th of July weekend, Brazel talked to family and friends. Norris Proctor remembered that someone suggested Brazel should try to claim the rewards being offered for proof that flying saucers were real. Others told him to notify the sheriff or the government because it was probably one of the military's experimental projects. Brazel again approached the Proctors, asking them to drive down to see the debris field. And again, they decided that they didn't have the time. It was too far. They suggested that it might be an experimental craft and that the military would want to know what happened to it. Brazel was reluctant only because neither he nor his neighbors had phones, and it was 3 or 4 hours' trip into Roswell. On Sunday, July 6th, Brazel decided it was time to make the trip into Roswell to see the sheriff. He stopped to tell Sheriff George A. Wilcox what he had. Brazell showed Wilcox a small piece of the debris. Wilcox suggested that they call the local air base. During this time, Frank Joyce, an announcer and reporter for Roswell radio station KGFL, called and asked the sheriff if he had anything going on. Wilcox put Brazell on the line, and Joyce interviewed him over the phone. Today, Joyce will not disclose what was said. Brazell contacted extraterrestrial, if it's a UFO, he had extraterrestrial exposure directly. Joyce had it indirectly. Back to the code. I also, when I open the phones with music in a moment, I want to know how many of you will fess up you didn't dream there was any such federal regulation on the books, which would make you a bit cautious in approaching extraterrestrial potential matter of any kind. Today, Joyce will not disclose what was said, only that it was significantly different from what Brazell told him 3 days later. The military responded quickly to the sheriff's phone call. Major Jesse A. Marcel was in the officers' club eating lunch when he was told that someone had showed up in the sheriff's office with parts of a flying saucer. Marcel, along with Colonel William Blanchard and a plainclothes counterintelligence agent, responded each in his own vehicle. It was only a few minutes later that Marcel arrived, followed by the CIC man, counterintelligence, and then Blanchard. Wilcox said afterward that it seemed as if the military men were waiting for the call because they got there so fast. They all, the military men and the sheriff's deputies, examined the pieces Brazell brought in. No one could identify the material, and Blanchard, still at the base, ordered Marcel to accompany the rancher back to Corona. The counterintelligence man said he was going to. Not boring you.
No, sir.
Brazell led them back out to his ranch using the back roads, including the Pine Lodge Road. Because it was nearly dark when they reached the ranch house, they had no choice but to spend the night. They ate a cold dinner of canned beans and crackers and spent the night waiting for the sun to come up. I don't think I'd go out there in the dark either. Early the next morning, July 7th, 1947, Brazell took them out to the crash site. Marcel said that the debris was scattered over an area 3/4 of a mile long and 200 to 300 feet wide. Marcel also said that there were pieces of material as thin as newsprint that couldn't be bent or dented. There was some lead foil-like material, I-beams, and parchment-like paper. Marcel closely examined the debris. According to Marcel, he picked up a piece about 3 feet square. It was as light as a feather, but so strong that he couldn't bend it or flex it. It was dull gray. Marcel also picked up one of the small 2-foot-long I-beams. The inside of the eye was covered with symbols, most of them geometric shapes. The eye beam was lightweight, would flex slightly, but was very strong. Brazell watched Marcel and the CIC agent examine the material and then left. According to Marcel, the two men spent the day picking up the debris. They loaded it into the rear of Marcel's 42 Buick convertible and into the rear of the CIC agent's Jeep carryall. As it began to get dark, they gave up on the idea of collecting it all. It was just too much of it. They found Brazell, told him they were returning to Roswell, but someone would probably return the next day to retrieve the remainder of the material. The next morning, the counterintelligence agent, accompanied by another agent, Lewis S. Rickett, and several MPs, cordoned off the area. Quarantine. Title 14, 1211. The two CIC men went in search of Brazil while the Provost Marshal Major Edwin D. Easley began stationing his men around the crash site. When Brazil was located, they took him to Roswell and kept him at the base. Quarantine. Title 14, 1211. His son, Bill Brazil, said he was asked to stay down there, and he agreed. If the old man had said, "Hell no, I'm not going," I don't really know what would have happened. But he said, "Yep." They just asked him to go down there and to stay for a day or two, and he stayed. I don't know what would have happened either if he had said no. But I think I do. When asked how long Mac Brazil might have been held, Bill Brazil then said, "I was living in Albuquerque at the time. I got the paper and I looked at it, and here's my dad's picture." I said to Shirley, his wife, I guess, "What the hell did he do now?" I read about it, and they said that he wasn't being held, but that they had asked him to stay in Roswell for a few days. Well, because the law says you're deemed doing it voluntarily. And I told Shirley, "Dad needs help." So I proceeded out to the ranch. I think that it was two or three days before my dad showed up. I said, "What did you get into?" And he said, "Oh, I found a thing out there." On July 9, 1947, Brazil was escorted by military officers into Roswell to talk to reporters at the office of the Roswell Daily Record. Two reporters from Albuquerque had brought a portable wire photo transmitter with them so they could transmit pictures over the telephone lines. Brazil told reporters that he had originally found the debris on June 14th while on the ranch with his daughter, Bessie, his son, Vernon, and his wife. In that interview, while the military officers watched and listened, Brazil now claimed the object was smoky gray rubber and that it was confined to an area of about 200 yards in diameter. You want to stay here the rest of your life, man, or you want to tell this story with us listening in? I'm really sorry the hippies lost their guts and became yuppies. And they figured out where this government was going. But they just decided to join it. While no words were visible, there were letters on part of it along with a little scotch tape and some tape with flowers printed on it. Although no strings or wires were fastened to it, a few eyelets in the paper indicating an attachment might have been used. This new story ended with Brazil saying he had found weather observation devices on two other occasions, but this object didn't resemble those. "I'm sure what I found was not any weather observation balloon," he said. A rare burst of truth in this controlled environment with the military watching him, escorting him to talk to the press. The escort officers then took Brazil out of the newspaper offices. While they were walking toward the car, two of Brazil's neighbors, Floyd Proctor and Lyman Strickland, saw him. Both were surprised that Brazil didn't say a word to them. Proctor said later that the military was keeping Brazil on a short leash. They weren't the only ones to see Brazil under escort. Leonard Porter, who lived on the ranch south of Brazil, and Bill Jenkins, another neighbor — I hope some of you listening on Channel 2 know some of these people — reported they saw Brazil in downtown Roswell. According to Porter, Brazil was surrounded by the military. Brazell, according to Porter, kept his eyes down, pretending that he couldn't see anyone. What would you do? You want to stay? I mean, you know, I never heard of this code section and it's shoved in my face. You want to stay here forever? Or you want to, for national security reasons, tell the story? Well, I'll tell the story. But just to make sure, we're going to stay with you while you do it. Brazell got into the car and was taken to radio station KGFL, where he went inside alone. According to Frank Joyce, Brazell stood against the wall and told the cover story that the Army had given him. It was a balloon that had come down. Joyce said he knew the story wasn't true. He listened to it and then pointed out that it was not the same story that Brazell had told a couple of days earlier before the Army had gotten to him. Specifically, Brazell had mentioned nothing about his family being with him or that the debris field was only 200 yards in diameter. Joyce said that Brazell kept on repeating the news story, but then said, "It'll go hard on me." Joyce could tell that Brazell was agitated. Joyce remained at the radio station control board throughout the discussion. Finally, Brazell turned and walked out of the building. The military officers were walking outside, were waiting outside the station. With the news story firmly in place, Brazell was taken back to the base. Let me continue.
Yes, sir.
Marion Strickland, a neighbor of Brazell, said later that Mac Brazell had been held in jail. They hadn't let him leave the base. She remembered him sitting at her kitchen table in late July or early August talking about being held by the military. They had kept him in Roswell and refused to let him even call his wife to let her know where he was. What'd I tell you? Title 14, Section 1211. Brazell remained in custody in Roswell for approximately 8 days. Bill Brazell said originally that his father was in Roswell for 2 or 3 at the most, but when a timeline is worked out, 2 or 3 days doesn't cover the period adequately. According to Bill Brazell, he learned his father was in Roswell on July 10th. That was the first time he'd seen his father's name mentioned in either of the Albuquerque newspapers. Bill Brazell did not arrive at the ranch until 2 or 3 days after that, on the weekend of July 12th to 13th. His father did not return for another 2 or 3 days. That meant Mac Brazell returned sometime between July 14th and July 16th. He was in custody on July 8th and therefore was held for 6 to 8 days. When Brazell returned, he didn't talk much about what had happened to him in Roswell. Some of his neighbors reported that he now talked about finding a weather balloon. Tommy Tyree said Brazell told him that it had been one of those Japanese balloon bombs launched during World War II, but privately, to his family and to his closest friends, Brazell told a slightly different story. Bill Brazell said, "My dad found this thing and told me a little bit about it. Not much, because the Air Force asked him to take an oath that he wouldn't tell anybody in detail about it. And my dad was such a guy that he went to his grave and he never told anybody." All Mac Brazell would say was that whatever it wasn't any type of balloon. He told Bill Brazell that he was better off not knowing a thing about it. His neighbors noticed a change in Mac Brazell's lifestyle when he returned from Roswell. Brazel or Brazell, I hope somebody tell me how it should be pronounced, suddenly seemed to have more money. Loretta Proctor said that Mac never had 2 nickels to rub together, but when he returned, he drove a new pickup truck. North Proctor said that Brazell also had the money to buy a new house in Tularosa, New Mexico, and a meat locker in Las Cruces. Tommy Tyree said that Mac Brazell was a frugal man and that he and his wife saved almost all his pay from working the ranch. However, Paul Brazel, another of Mac's sons, was angry when neighbors began to claim Mac had been paid off by the government. Paul Brazel said that the government had given his father nothing. None of the witnesses still living know exactly what happened to Mac Brazel while he was in Roswell. Marion Strickland claims that Mac was held in jail and asked the same questions over and over again. When pressed on that point, Strickland made it clear Brazel wasn't in the jail in Roswell, but he wasn't allowed to leave the base either. Others agree. Mac Brazel was detained by the military for about a week. By the time Mac Brazel returned to the ranch, all signs of the debris were gone. The wreckage had been packed into trucks by the military and taken away. Months later, while riding the range, Brazel spotted a piece of debris in a sinkhole. He pointed it out to his ranch hand, but neither man climbed down from their horses to retrieve it. At that time, it seemed to be more trouble than it was worth, but even had Brazel picked it up, he would never have been able to hold on to it. The military was still watching. July 6 to 10, 1947, Chavez County Sheriff. Years later, George A. Wilcox... You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
Why? The Chavez County Sheriff in July 1947 would complain about the way the military handled the retrieval of the flying saucer. He was angry with himself for bringing in the military because they claimed jurisdiction and completely cut him out of it. If he had had to do it over again, he said he would have notified the press first and let the reporters get to the crash site before he told the Army a thing about it. Brazel arrived at the jail sometime on the afternoon of Sunday, July 6, 1947, according to the witnesses. Deputy B.A. Clark took the initial report and then turned it over to Sheriff Wilcox. Because Brazel was an old-time cowboy dressed in old clothes and scuffed boots, Wilcox didn't pay much attention when Brazel walked in. But Brazel not only brought a story of a crash flying saucer, he had some of the material with him. Material neither Wilcox nor Clark could identify. Although Brazel's branch was in Lincoln County, Roswell is in Chavez County. That Roswell was the hub of that area in New Mexico. The ranchers and the people around didn't worry about fine lines between counties. Roswell was the place where business was conducted, and it would have been natural for Brazel to go there rather than Carrizozo. Wilcox figured the best thing to do was call the military at the base. According to his daughter, Phyllis McGuire, the military arrived at the office almost as the sheriff got off the phone. There had been no discussion about Brazel being crazy or whether the sheriff was sure if the material was unusual. The military officers came as soon as they were notified. Now, McGuire doesn't remember who arrived. She was chased out of the jail while the men discussed what Brazel had found. They were in a small room off the main office with Brazel and a box of debris that he brought with him. She did remember, however, that her father sent two of his deputies out to the ranch. The two deputies left the office for the Corona area. Although the military officers might not be familiar with the ranches outside of Roswell, the sheriff's deputies were. Brazel had described the location of the debris field, and they felt confident they could find it. They returned, however, saying that they had seen no debris. They had come upon an area of blackened ground. It looked as if something large and circular had touched down. The ground had been baked to a hardness that surprised them both. Jay Tulk, the husband of one of Wilcox's daughters, arrived at the jail after the military arrived. He asked the sheriff what was happening. He had seen the military vehicles parked outside. Tulk and Wilcox went into the small room and talked about it there. The military and Brazel left the office about dusk before the deputies returned. Wilcox called the base, but no one there had any new information. With Brazell and the military officers gone, and because the deputies had found nothing but the circular burn on the ranch, things quieted down. On Monday, July 7th, they heard nothing new about the debris or what the military had found out there, but on Tuesday, July 8th, things changed radically. Wilcox, wondering what had happened, dispatched another two deputies to the ranch. McGuire and her sister, Elizabeth Tulk, thought that the sheriff might have traveled out there himself. It doesn't matter now whether it was two deputies or the sheriff and a deputy, because they couldn't get close. The Army had cordoned off the roads and was stopping and turning back all traffic, even deputy sheriffs. For weather balloon? Since they were from Chavez County, they had no real legal status in Lincoln County, not to mention the fact that the Army was a federal agency. Wilcox then tried to get more answers from the military at the base, but again, no one had much to say. Then, about noon, Walter Hout issued a press release. From that point, the sheriff and his deputies were busy fielding phone calls from around the world. McGuire said that her father was up all night taking calls from Germany, England, France, and Italy, as well as every state in the Union. Where's Peter? Come over here real quick. Lieutenant Walter Hout, public information officer at the Roswell Army Base. Here's his picture. Roswell Army Base public information officer, First Lieutenant Walter G. Hout, the man responsible for the release of the Roswell statement. Want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
Get on telephone. Santa Fe, New Mexico. Watching on Channel 2. I've just started watching Dr. Scott. What does he think about intelligent life from other planets? I think it's out there. What does that do to your Christian faith? Nothing. I'd hate to think God exhausted his creative powers in what I see around me every day. Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm watching and appreciating the exploration of UFOs. I'm very aware that they do exist. Los Alamos, New Mexico. I'd like to know the book you're reading from. It's very interesting. UFO Crash at Roswell by Kevin Randall and Donald Smith. It'll be bought out of every bookstore by tomorrow night. Los Alamos, out here in UFO land, continue. Sounds very intriguing to me. Santa Fe, New Mexico, I've been watching for a couple of weeks, and it's great. We think the military is doing strange things. I know a person who knows the Brazells. The Roswell and other strange incidents are talked about here every day. If I found something, the last person I'd tell would be the Army. I've heard him say, if you've been taught support, I've been taught, I'll send, and they tell me how much to Post Office Box 1. That's an intelligent person. Albuquerque, New Mexico, I'm very interested in this subject. Tell Doc, keep on teaching. Los Alamos, Doc, have you ever read The Watchers, the Raymond Fowler? Yes, I have. Albuquerque, New Mexico, fascinated by the incident, Roswell story. Want to hear more. And Albuquerque, please send me your magazine. You can all have the Truth magazine free. Just ask for it. My wife and I have been watching for a couple of nights and find you wonderful. Please don't change that opinion. About noon, July 8th, Walter Haupt, the information officer at the Army base, can you believe David Letterman was bothered with my two sets of glasses? That's all he could talk about one night. With some of his antics, he bothered about my... I believe in conserving time. Why you wear colored glasses? Because I like them. That's supposed to be the right answer, but when you sat and looked at these lights for 16 years, you decide... Why punish yourself? And it takes two motions to take this one off and put these on. And as long as I can get them there, I consider what I'm doing very intelligent. Everybody ought to do what I do. I mean, I got a cigar in one hand, a book in the other hand, and two sets of glasses. We'd be off of lifetime before I got the glasses changed if I did it the way some people want it done. About noon, Walter Haupt issued a press release. From that point, the sheriff and his deputies were busy fielding phone calls from around the world. McGuire said that her father was up all night taking calls from Germany, England, France, and Italy, as well as every state in the Union. Soon afterward, July 9th or 10th, Wilcox was visited by military officers. They wanted to retrieve the box of debris that had been left in the small room. They wanted everything, didn't they? The sheriff made sure that it had been guarded. Now the military wanted that, and they wanted to order the sheriff to say as little as possible about the events and to refer all calls to the base. Although Wilcox was a civilian law enforcement official or officer, he did have a working relationship with the base. When one of the men there got into trouble in Roswell, the sheriff would alert the provost marshal. Because of that, and because it seemed that the crash was a military matter, Wilcox felt obligated to keep the facts to himself. Phyllis McGuire wanted to know more about what happened. She pestered her father, asking questions about what Brazell had found, what the military had been doing there, and about the flying saucer itself. Finally, her mother, Inez Wilcox, knowing that the military had told the sheriff to keep quiet, told Phyllis to stop asking the questions. Wilcox never found out what Brazell had discovered. The only contacts he had with the military after he had called them was a warning against talking about the discovery. They would answer no questions from him. Wilcox had no need to know, and the military wasn't about to share the information with him. Wilcox's role was minor but important. Without his phone call, the information might have spread farther, faster, so that the Army would not have been able to contain it. With that one phone call, Wilcox helped create a mystery that continues to endure. July 7, 1947, the debris field. Yeah, you want me to... You know, I can go home and read this. Because Marcel and the counterintelligence agent arrived about dusk on the evening of July 6, 1947, there was no opportunity to see the crash site. The area where it happened is desolate even today. There are no street lights, and in fact, a few roads are little more than areas scraped clean by road graders. Fence lines and gates make it difficult to get from one place to the next. It is a cross-country drive to the actual site. In 1978, Lynn Stringfield interviewed Jesse Marcel about his role in the recovery operation. Marcel, the Army man, said that they had arrived too late to do much the first day. Brazell showed them the largest chunk he had found, a piece about 10 feet in diameter that he had dragged from the field. It gave them an idea of the approximate size of the craft that came down. It also gave them some idea of the find's unbelievable nature. But at night, in an old house that had no electricity, there was nothing for them to do with the material except check it for radiation. Marcel found none. At dawn, Brazel took them to the debris field. According to neighbors, including Norris Proctor, Brazel was an early riser, was normally up an hour or two before the sun. He used to sit around drinking coffee until it was light enough to go to work. The morning of July 7th, 1947 would be, or would have been, no different. Without breakfast, they headed to the crash site. From the ranch house where they had spent the night, it wasn't far. However, there were no roads, and the country was rough. They had to drive to the east, then south, and finally back to the west. The debris field was oriented northwest to southeast. Marcel said it was about 3/4 of a mile long and 200 to 300 feet across. Much different than what Brazel said with his military escort listening. With a gouge at the top end of it that was about 500 feet long and 10 feet wide. Debris littered the ground lying on top of it. The wind blew some of it around because of the material's light weight. Oh, you're still there. To skip along, back to Joyce, the radio man. Joyce said that he had talked to Brazel while Mac was still in Sheriff Wilcox's office on Sunday, July 6th. A lot of fine details about the interviews and the gathering of the debris and all that. And then a kickback. According to him, he had called the sheriff to see if there was anything interesting happening, and Wilcox handed the phone over to Brazel. Joyce had the story, according to him, a full day before anyone else. Now, a few days later, Brazel was back telling him a different story. According to Joyce, Brazel was under a great deal of stress. He could tell that Brazel was saying things that he didn't believe. Newspapers around the country were carrying the explanation of the Roswell saucer. Even papers that hadn't reported the capture were telling readers that the disc found in New Mexico was nothing more than a weather balloon. The pictures, those of Ramey and DuBose and Jesse Marcel, were printed throughout the country. The debris spread out on the floor of Ramey's office looked just like a weather balloon. Everything seemed to be open and above board. The military, both in Roswell and Fort Worth, seemed to be telling the truth. The reports of saucers and related stories began to disappear from the papers. Explanations for them grew to include hallucinations and illusions. On July 9th, the Las Vegas Review-Journal, among other newspapers, reported that the Army and the Navy had moved to stop the rumors of flying saucers. As far as the press around the world was concerned, the Roswell saucer was nothing more than a weather balloon. The radio reporters in Roswell who had talked to the people involved knew better, but their broadcast licenses had been threatened. They had been told that the minute they finished their reports, they would be off the air. No one challenged that authority, especially when it came from New Mexico's own Washington congressional delegation, including the powerful Senator Dennis Chavez. But Frank Joyce knew the weather balloon was a quickly manufactured cover story. When his second interview with Brazel ended, the rancher walked to the door. Then, according to Joyce, Brazel turned to him and said, "Frank, you know how they talk of little green men? They weren't green." Brazel then opened the door and left with his military escort. More? Get on telephone. Santa Fe, New Mexico. We've been watching for a couple of weeks, and we love this guy. Have you read the Arantia book? Yes, I have. Albuquerque, watching on Channel 2. What is the book you're reading from? UFO Crash at Roswell by Randall and Smith. We're interested because we live in New Mexico. I want the folks in New Mexico to call me about this. Albuquerque, I want you to please continue. This is fascinating. I worked for the Air Force Base in New Mexico in 53 and had no idea of these goings-on. Getting late. Shall I continue? Wreckage from the crash site was brought to Roswell by Mac Brazell in the back of Marcel's 42 convertible, the Jeep Carryall, and in subsequent days, a variety of trucks. The first wreckage recovered was scrap, the result of either the explosion that had stripped the outer surface from the craft, or from the rip in the hull that had sucked debris from the interior. However it happened, the debris field was covered with those scraps. The first of the wreckage was flown out of Roswell on Sunday, July 6th, on orders from General Clements McMullen. It was some of the material that Brazell had brought in to show the sheriff. According to Colonel, now General, Thomas DuBose, he received a call from Washington sometime between 2 and 3 in the afternoon of July 6th and was told that the men in Roswell had found something on the ground. The debris or elements were to be placed in a suitable container, and Blanchard was to see that they were delivered, and Al Clark would pick them up and deliver them to General McMullen. When the flight from Roswell arrived at Fort Worth, Texas, both DuBose and Colonel Allen B. Clark were waiting. DuBose said that he saw the container that held the debris, and according to DuBose, I saw only the container, and the container was a plastic bag that I would say weighed 15 or 20 pounds. It was sealed. A lead seal was around the top, and the only way to get into it was to cut it. DuBose never talked to the pilot of the aircraft from Roswell. Clark took the plastic bag, then walked over to the Command B-26. That was the plane he used to fly the first of the wreckage to Washington so that McMullen and the others could examine it. It was 2 days before any more of the wreckage was flown out. Marcel, who along with a counterintelligence agent had picked up more of it, remained at the Roswell base. On Tuesday, he was told by Blanchard that he would be going to 8th Air Force Headquarters in Fort Worth later that day with more of the material. This was the second of several flights carrying wreckage. According to Robert Porter, a crewman on that flight, there were only four small packages. They checked the aircraft, a B-29, and then a staff car from building 1034 had brought the material out to load on the plane. Porter said they handed the material up to him through the hatch. The largest of the pieces was 2.5 feet to 3 feet across, 3 to 4 inches thick, and was triangular shaped. The other three packages were about the size of shoe boxes and all felt as if they were empty. According to Porter, the flight was ordered by Major Ralph R. Taylor, the 830th Squadron Operations Officer. The flight crew consisted of Lieutenant Colonel Payne Jennings as the pilot, with Lieutenant Colonel Robert Barrowclough as in the bombardier's seat, and Porter said that he thought T.S.G.T. George Aides and T.S.G.T. William Cross were on the plane, and he knew that T.S.G.T. Sterling Bone was there, and Jesse Marcel. Once the packages were on the plane, they were passed to the rear of the forward compartment, and Porter said he could no longer see them. When the plane arrived at the Fort Worth Army Airfield, Porter and the other enlisted men were told to stay with the aircraft until a guard was posted. When that was done, they were allowed to go to the mess hall to eat. According to him, the material was transferred to a B-25 flown on to Wright Field. As they got back on the plane, they were told that the material in their B-29 was nothing more than a weather balloon. They flew back to Roswell. Once they arrived in Fort Worth, Porter lost sight of the material. He didn't see it loaded on the B-25, and he only had been removed from his aircraft after the trip. Jesse Marcel took it with him as he left, and it was Marcel or someone at 8th Air Force who loaded it on the B-25, and there wasn't much of it. Hardly enough to account for the debris that Marcel had described earlier, just enough material to make the story of a weather balloon sound plausible. Certainly not enough material to make up a spacecraft. But Porter's flight wasn't the only one. In the days that followed, other crews flew material out of Roswell. Captain O.W. Pappy Henderson flew a C-54 load of wreckage onto Wright Field. He kept that flight a secret from everyone, including his wife, Sappho, until the early 1980s. Then after seeing an article in a tabloid, he told her, "I guess I don't have to keep it a secret anymore." Henderson, who died in 1986, told Sappho that he had wanted to tell her about it for years. He knew that flying saucers were real because he had flown a plane load of wreckage onto Wright Field. He didn't tell her much about it except that the wreckage was strange. The flight's destination had been Dayton and back again. She said that it had been a C-54. Sappho Henderson said that she had never asked her husband for the details. He had told her the material was strange but did not elaborate. He said the article he saw, including the descriptions of the bodies, was accurate, and he described the bodies to her. Too late. Henderson was a member of the 1st Air Transport Unit, which was assigned to the Roswell Army Airfield. Colonel Jennings was the deputy base and group commander, and Bearclaw was the base executive officer, and Marcel was the group intelligence officer. All were in the 509th Bomb Group headquarters. The first flight taking the material to Fort Worth had been a very special one, as evidenced by the makeup of the crew. Too many of the top men at Roswell were assigned to that crew. The second flight was not quite as special, but was as highly classified. Henderson later said that it was a routine flight except for the high classification. Henderson kept the secret as long as he thought it was required of him, but once the information was published, he didn't mind sharing it with his friends. In 1982, at a reunion of his flight crew from World War II, he told them about flying the wreckage of a spacecraft out of Roswell. There, at the reunion, he mentioned that he flew the airplane to Wright Field and he mentioned the bodies. And again, because of the nature of the story, those listening were skeptical until they saw Pappy was serious. The discussion then went to other UFO sightings. Pappy made comments about flying saucers on other occasions, always telling his listeners that he believed in them because so many other pilots reported seeing them. He never broke his silence about his own role until he saw that article. Sappho remembered that while they still lived in Roswell, Pappy had been outside with Mary Catherine, his daughter, staring into the night sky. When asked what he was doing, he told her, "Looking for flying saucers, the real, you know." Porter's flight to Fort Worth with a small sample of the material and Henderson's special flight to Wright Field weren't the only aircraft dispatched. Like Henderson, other members of the first transport were involved in moving wreckage from Roswell to other locations. Robert E. Smith was a sergeant with the 1st Air Transport in July 1947. According to him, he spent one day loading three aircraft with the material that had been picked up at the crash site. In a recent interview, he told about the scene at the airfield on the morning of July 9, 1947. "We started out in the morning, say about 8 or 9 o'clock. Seems like it lasted up to nearly 4 o'clock with a break for lunch. The reason I say it took so long is the weight and level guy worked to determine how much each crate weighed. He had to counterbalance the aircraft. The crates were made of plywood with 1-inch furring strips on the edges. The crates were from 4 to 6 feet wide, 8 to 10 feet long, and 3 or 4 feet high. There was a variety of them, and they were all fairly light. The problem wasn't the weight, but the size. Smith said that some of them were hard to handle because they were 6 feet tall and 3 or 4 feet wide. The crates were marked, but he couldn't remember what the markings said. He didn't know that the crates were top secret and that several armed guards were posted around the hangar where they were working. When Smith and his men finished the three aircraft were sealed. Smith said the procedure required any aircraft flying on to Los Alamos to land at Kirtland Air Force Base first. The pilot would leave the aircraft, go to the base ops, receive a sealed envelope. He would be escorted to base ops and escorted back by MPs. We would get airborne. He would have to open the envelope for the passage code. There were three codes in there. We had three positions that we had to answer. At one time, we had a green, inexperienced pilot, and he stumbled on one of the passage codes, and they fired some warning shots at us, and we had to go back to Kirtland. Security was extremely tight. I would assume that when these planes went up there, went to Kirtland, they got their passage codes to go in. All I know is they went up there, and they weren't up there over a day. Smith and a couple of the other sergeants discussed the nature of the cargo as they were loading the aircraft. Smith said, "We were talking about what was in the crates and so forth, and he and other of the NCOs said, 'Oh, you remember the story about the UFO, or rather the flying saucer?' That was what we called them back then. We thought he was joking, but he let us steal a piece, and he stuck it back into his pocket. Afterwards, we got to talking a little bit more about it, and he said he'd been out there helping clean this up. He didn't think taking a little piece like that would matter. With just a little piece of metal or foil or whatever it was, just small enough to be slipped into a pocket, I think he picked it up for a souvenir. It was foil-like, but it was a little stiffer than foil that we have now. In fact, being a sheet metal man, it kind of intrigued me, being that you could crumple it and it would flatten back out again without any wrinkles showing up in it. Of course, we didn't get to look at it too close because it's supposed to be top secret. He just popped it out real quick and let us feel it and so forth while everybody was doing something else." Explaining how the man might have gotten the piece, Smith said, "I know there was a pretty good gathering of them. They went across the field about a couple feet apart, just kept going across, picking up pieces, loading them into wheelbarrows and things like that, and carrying them to the sentry point. The three flights, all C-54s from First Air Transport, were not the last flights out of Roswell. One man said he was involved in a special flight on his B-29, The plane flew directly to Fort Worth, was there only long enough for the crate to be unloaded, and then returned to Roswell. The flight log showed the whole trip took just under 2 hours on July 9, 1947, and there was a final flight that carried some of the material out of New Mexico along with passengers. The counterintelligence people came into Roswell on a special flight from Andrews Air Field on July 8. This flight, described by Lieutenant Colonel Joe Briley, Frank Kaufman, and Louis S. Rickert, also carried material out of Roswell on its return to Washington, D.C. According to the testimony of the participants, there were several flights carrying wreckage or bodies. One flew to Fort Worth and then on to Wright Field. Another flew to Wright Field directly. Three flew to Los Alamos, and one flew to Andrews in Washington. If what Mac Brazell found was only a weather balloon, would the Army have wasted so much time and effort transporting pieces of it all over the country? If it had been a weather balloon, wouldn't they have just thrown it away when they realized what it was? If it was a weather balloon, why were there so many flights made under such tight security?" Questions are rhetorical. The story gets muddled when the search for bodies begins. Now we get to the good part. For years, there have been rumors of alien bodies from crash saucers, but no one ever offered any proof that they existed. There was even talk of cryonic suspension at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and there were rumors of special rooms with special equipment, none of which could be confirmed. The logical extension of the crashed disc theory was that the craft also contained a flight crew. Although only a few people had ever mentioned seeing bodies, there were enough solid leaks to warrant further investigation. According to the currently accepted version, Grady L. Barney Barnett and the members of an archaeological team who followed him into the site saw bodies during the summer of 1947. Barnett, while working near Magdalena on the plains of St. Augustine, said he had come upon the wreckage of a disc-shaped craft and saw the dead bodies of the crew. Within minutes, the military, led by a red-haired officer, had arrived, sworn him and the archaeologist to secrecy. The archaeologists never publicly revealed what they saw, and Barnett told only a few of his closest friends. According to that version of the story, Barnett found the crash on July 3rd. If the military had found bodies on July 3rd, they would have realized that they had discovered an extraterrestrial craft. Given that and 5 days to make plans, it is doubtful that Colonel Blanchard would have told Walter Haupt to issue a press release about the debris Mac Brazel found. In other words, the cover-up would have started on July 3, 1947, and there would have been no story in the July 8 newspapers. In July 1947, a number of people were in the Dateo, Magdalena, and Plains of St. Augustine area of New Mexico. Many of them are still alive. None of them remember any stories circulating about alien ships and dead bodies. That seemed to effectively eliminate the possibility of a second crash near Magdalena. But there is another more devastating piece of evidence. Ruth Barnett, the wife of Barney, kept a daily diary. According to that document, Barney spent the day of July 3, 1947 in the office. There was no time for Barney to be in the field, find a crash flying disc, and get home. That, of course, did not rule out the possibility of a second crash site. Research suggests that the second crash site was not near Magdalena, but much closer to the first site. And the bodies were not found on July 3rd, but late on July 8th. Mac Brazel had been picked up by the counterintelligence agents on July 8th. He was taken back to Roswell, where an aerial search was arranged. Because the country around Brazel House has few landmarks, those unfamiliar with it can become lost in a matter of minutes. One canyon looks like the next. It was hoped that Brazel would be able to direct ground parties to any debris spotted from the air. The first aerial survey discovered a second crash site. You still with it? About 2.5 miles to the southeast of the first. That was where the ship came down and where the bodies were located. But before the military on the ground could be directed to the new site, Barney Barnett and the archaeologists stumbled onto the wreckage. The references to the plains of San Augustine and Magdalena have been inaccurate. According to L.W. Vern Maltese, Barney Barnett told him a few years later that he had seen the bodies of beings from another planet. There were three or four of them, all wearing one-piece gray suits with no sign of buttons, snaps, or zippers. They were small creatures, 4 to 5 feet tall, with large pear-shaped heads, small bodies, and skinny arms and legs. Maltese said that Barnett never really described the object, saying only that it was metallic, dull gray, and was pretty good sized. Barnett said that it seemed to have burst open. It was jammed up against a ridgeline, and there was no wreckage scattered around it, but because there were bodies outside the craft, Barnett's attention had been drawn to them. He was close enough to touch one had he wanted to. Moments after he found the bodies, a small group of people appeared. Barnett said they were archaeologists who were working in the area. They too saw the bodies and the craft, but before anyone could do anything, the military arrived. Barnett never learned who the archaeologists were or where they were from. He didn't have the chance to talk to them. The military warned everyone that what they had seen was a classified project and that it was their patriotic duty to keep what they had seen to themselves. They were then escorted off the site. Ruth Barnett's diary for July 8, 1947 said that Barney was in the Pytown area on the far side of the plains of San Augustine, as far from Barnett's home in Socorro as the actual crash site near Corona is. According to the diary, Barnett got home about 8:30 p.m. The question becomes, because of the orders of the military officers, Did Barnett mention Pie Town because it was so far away? Was he covering his tracks by suggesting it was more than 300 miles from the crash site? Was he actually in Lincoln County on July 8th? After the civilians were gone, the military brought in trucks and a few dozen men to clean the site. The bodies were loaded into the back of one of the trucks, in which there were large blocks of ice. About dusk, Sergeant Melvin E. Brown and one other soldier were stationed in the truck with orders not to look under the tarp. Brown could not resist the temptation, and as soon as his superiors moved away, he pulled the tarp aside. There he saw I'm still at 197. Well, I ain't going to tell you what he saw until I get over 200.